Right. Well, so let me begin by thanking the organizers for inviting me to give this talk at this meeting, and also for ruining my Easter weekend. Because when I carefully thought about what might be of interest to you here, then I thought that if you wanted to have a smorgasbord kind of talk about Rick experimental results, you would have invited an experimentalist. And rather, that what you would like to hear is something about what at least someone in the community thinks about are interesting theoretical challenges that have emerged or are stimulated by the Rick data. And so that's what I'll try to do here. And of course, I have to select, and I apologize to anyone who thinks that I've missed the most important challenge. As you know, the road to the quark-gluon plasma, which is one way of looking at Rick, is circular. It's about 3 miles long in circumference, and it is a collider in which you can, in principle, accelerate a lot of different nuclei, beginning with protons, deuterium, up to gold, and collide them at energies up to 100 GeV per nucleon. The collisions are observed by 4 detectors, Phoenix, Star, Phobos, and Brown's, which have various capabilities, but in general excel at measuring many different particles that are produced in the collision and trying to sort physically interesting observables out of these measurements. The goal, of course, was to have experimental access to the QCD phase diagram. And here is a cartoon of what we today think this diagram looks like. Do we have a pointer? That's okay. So we have here the point that we know pretty well, namely atomic nuclei in their ground state. And then we have 2 directions in which we can go, either compressing the baryon density or heating up matter in the vertical direction. We think there is a first-order transition line separating a currently phase in which current symmetry is broken dynamically, in addition to the breaking that comes through the finite quark masses, from a region in which current symmetry is approximately restored. We think that this line terminates in a critical point somewhere in the plane, and we are fairly sure at this point that when you go along 0 chemical baryon chemical potential but upwards in temperature, there is no discontinuous transition. Rick, in this context, explores the region of matter over here with fairly small chemical potential, not 0, but of the order of, say, 30 to 50 MeV, and temperatures in the range of somewhere between 170 and maybe 300 MeV. So we're close to where actually matter was existed in the early universe in the first 10 or 20 microseconds. A simple cartoon of what happens in a nuclear collision is this. You have the 2 beams coming in, you have a first moment of hard interactions, a collision, in which energy density is produced outside the nuclei. You have a short pre-equilibrium phase terminating in a moment or a range of moments at which equilibrium is achieved, then a thermalized state, the quark-gluon plasma, which eventually cools down to the critical temperature and forms a hadron gas, which then dissembles. In order to get a feeling of where Rick produces this matter, one uses a formula that was first written down by Bjorken in 1983, I believe, based on the hydrodynamic evolution of matter in a boost invariant one-dimensional scenario, where the energy density can be expressed in terms of the transverse energy, that is the energy contained in masses and transverse momenta per unit of rapidity divided by the volume filled by that matter. This is certainly greater than the final transverse energy per unit of rapidity observed, because there's work done in the longitudinal direction in expansion, which subtracts from the transverse energy as a function of time, divided by the initial space-time volume mapped out by the two nuclei along here, one of these hyperbolas. And if you put in numbers for a proper time of one Fermi over C, which is a standard choice, and you take the measurements of the experiments at RIC, you find that the energy density had to be larger than 4.5 GeV per cubic Fermi, which puts it well and safely above the energy density where lattice calculations indicate the rapid transition from a hadronic gas to a quark-gluon plasma should occur. So this is why we're pretty confident that RIC does what it was designed to do. Now, there are two wealth coming out of this physics program. One is a wealth of data, and I show here just one snapshot of all the particles coming out of a gold-gold collision, a central gold-gold collision, as visualized by the Starry detector. The other one is a wealth of theoretical challenges. And really here I should have added more, but it was just limited by my patience of rotating the word challenging in PowerPoint. But that's about the number that I will talk about, although I will tell you, if you really go over it with a fine comb, the theoretical challenges picture should look more like this as well. So instead of giving you a full overview of what the experimental results are, and I come back to some of those later on, but I will just show you three cornerstone results, three results that were really, in a sense, unanticipated, but which are at the core of the theoretical challenges that we have. The first one is called the azimuthal anisotropy, or the elliptic flow. And the idea here is very simple. When you have a collision between two heavy nuclei at a non-zero impact parameter, a semi-peripheral collision, and the beam line is now in and out of the screen, the overlap region is an elongated ellipse, which means that if you produce matter here which is approximately thermalized, then the pressure gradients in the collision plane, that is in the horizontal directions, are larger than in the vertical direction. And since the force in fluid dynamics is proportional to the gradient of the pressure, you have a larger force on the matter in the horizontal direction than in the vertical direction, which leads then in the final state to a momentum anisotropy, which is exactly orthogonal on the initial spatial anisotropy. That is, you observe higher momenta along in the plane than in the vertical direction. This is usually parameterized by the expectation value of cosine 2 phi, where phi is the emission angle with respect to the horizontal axis, and it is called the elliptic flow velocity, V2. It turns out, and we'll come back to that in some more detail, that in order to convert this spatial anisotropy into a momentum anisotropy efficiently, you need to equilibrate and establish internal pressure in the system at an early time. And so this is it converts into a measurement of a determination of a lower limit, an upper limit of the equilibration time in such a system. These are the measurements here. I chose a particular one by the star detectors, but all the other detectors have very similar measurements. And what you see here is that the measurement of this flow parameter V2 as a function of the transverse momentum of identified particles, kaons and lambda hyperons in this case. The lines are what hydrodynamics predicts. Of course, at zero transverse momentum, there is no knowledge of what the direction is, and so this parameter has to go to zero. Hydrodynamic theory at very early thermalization, at about 0.6 Fermi over C, gives these lines, which differ for mesons and baryons slightly at small momenta, and they fit the data pretty well. So the conclusion from this is that we have equilibration at a very early time in the collision. The second result, that is a core result, is the jet quenching, the suppression of the emission of hadrons with high transverse momentum. And this is shown here with data for identified neutral pions from the Phoenix detector, where you plot the ratio of what you would expect in a nuclear of what you get in a nuclear collision, divided by what you would expect if a nuclear collision were simply a binary superposition of nucleon-nucleon collisions. For a phenomenon that is associated with a high transverse momentum, you would expect that perturbative QCD applies, and that therefore such a ratio should come out to be 1, at least in the limit where you go to high transverse momentum. And indeed, what you find is very different. In peripheral collisions, you find that the ratio becomes out about 1, which means that there is very little else going on than binary nucleon-nucleon interactions. But in central collisions, this ratio is suppressed by about a factor of 5. So there are many fewer hadrons coming out by a factor of 5 than you expect. And the interpretation of this phenomenon is in terms of the energy loss of hard scattered protons inside the matter, and therefore a reduction emission at a given transverse momentum. An experimental determination that this is actually something that has to do with the gold-gold collision rather than with the structure of the gold nucleus comes from the measurement of the same spectrum in deuteron-gold collisions, where, as a function of transverse momentum, you see actually a slight excess above 1, which is understood in terms of multiple scattering of protons as the deuteron goes through the gold nucleus. But certainly no quenching. The quenching is only observed in gold-gold. Yes? You produce more low-momentum particles. Okay. Now, at low-momentum particles, of course, the scaling does not go with the number of binary collisions. But there is energy conservation. You're absolutely right. So in other words, you could say that some of the energy in high-momentum particles is converted into entropy, that is, particle number, in the case of the nuclear collision. Yes. Yes. Well, it does not have to. The point is, you have a space-time picture in which, by the time that the particle tries to get out in the transverse direction, the gold nucleus is already gone. Right. Right. So, in other words, you have to think of it in terms of a rapidity picture, where this is in the central region, and the gold nucleus is somewhere as a projectile. Gone far away. No, but this is a very good question. The third interesting result that I wanted to mention here is that there is a surprising, originally puzzling difference between the behavior of baryons and mesons. I just explained to you that there was, at high transverse momenta, this suppression of the emission of neutral pions. And it turns out the same is true for kaons and charged pions and so forth. However, when the experiments looked at baryons, that is, protons, lambda hyperons, xis, and so forth, they found that in a fairly wide range where they could identify the particles, the suppression was not the same. Actually, in terms of protons, in the range in which they could be identified, there was no suppression at all, which is shown here. So here you see this factor of 5 suppression, or 4 or 5 suppression in this particular case, depending on which selections you do for the collisions, for pions, but for protons, there's no suppression. So why is that the case? That was originally a big puzzle, and we now believe that there is a difference in terms of the hadronization mechanism that makes these baryons behave as rather soft particles, but not as hard particles that come from fragmentation of hot-scattered protons. But we'll come back to that as well. So let me give you a brief overview of what I want to cover here in terms of theoretical challenges. We'll talk about QCD thermodynamics. In particular, what are the dynamic degrees of freedom? I will not talk much about the critical point because it does not pertain to the physics done at RIC, but of course it's a very interesting and very active field of research. We'll look at the question of thermalization. How and why can it be so fast as it is apparently observed? I'll talk about transport in a thermal medium, in particular viscosity and energy loss, and a bit about spectral functions, charmonium, not virtual photons. I want to go through this not in terms of this logic, but in terms of the stages that the relativistic heavy ion collision goes through. We start out with the initial collisions, which is effectively the breakup of the coherent wave function of the nuclei, and in particular the gluon field in these nuclei. Then talk about the pre-equilibrium phase, that is the process towards equilibration, which in many respects is the most puzzling phase after what we've learned from RIC. We then come back to equilibrium and the domain of standard lattice gauge theory and its relevance for the hydrodynamic expansion in the longitudinal transverse directions. And finally, I'll say some words about hadronization, whether there are interesting theoretically accessible domains in ET. Let's begin with the initial state. In a very simplified picture of a nucleus at very high energy, moving at very high momentum, it is composed of a bunch of a wave function of partons. And of course, what that wave function looks like depends on the resolution scale at which you look at it, as we know. What was pointed out originally by Gribov, Levin, and Riskin in 1983, and then following that by others in different ways of formulation, is that as you lower the resolution scale, or as you make the nucleus larger and larger, the density in the transverse plane of these gluons increases, eventually to the point where they begin to overlap and begin to interact. At this point, you can no longer neglect the mutual interactions among the gluons. That is, the linear evolution equation becomes a nonlinear evolution equation. And some of the excitement in the field has come up from the suggestion that in the limit of very high gluon density, this goes over into a universal state called the Kallergrass condensate, which emerges as a fixed point in a nonlinear evolution equation. In the sense that at ultimate energy, it does not matter which hadron you look at, whether it's a proton or a pion or a gold nucleus, the form of the wave function is always the same and universal. What differs is the energy at which this universal picture is reached. And it turns out that as you make the projectile larger and larger, you reach that universal limit earlier. An estimate of why that is so is simply obtained when you consider the product of the gluon density times the area. The gluon density, of course, is given by the gluon structure functions, x times g of x. And the area, of course, is pi times the radius of the projectile squared. You have to multiply this by alpha s for the interaction among the gluons divided by the resolution scale, and then you get an expression of this sort where the gluon density scales as a to the 1/3 because you compress all the gluons in a longitudinal cross-section into the transverse plane. So QS squared scales as a to the 1/3, and therefore you reach that saturation earlier for nuclei than for a proton. Now, an important thing to remember here is that the details of the space time picture depend very much on the gauge, and what is simple, say, in the light cone gauge becomes very complicated and takes on a very different form in a covariant gauge. People have tried to simulate, dynamically understand the dynamics of this breakup of the initial configuration by lattice simulations. Dynamical lattice simulations, not static lattice simulations. The idea here is that you start out with color charges in the nuclei, which you say are random, because they originate from many different uncorrelated nucleons. And are described approximately by a Gaussian ensemble, the width of which is given by the saturation scale, QS. And then you can, in a Hamiltonian formulation, explore the time evolution of the glue fields generated by these color charges in a transverse plane. The approximation that is made here is that the system is boost invariant. In other words, it doesn't matter whether this plane sits here in the middle or is co-moving at some other point in the direction of the beam axis. It then becomes equivalent to a two-dimensional lattice simulation, Hamiltonian lattice simulation, with an associated Higgs field. These have been done by various people, Krasnitsnara and Venugopalan, and by Lappi in Helsinki, and they have shown consistently that the equipartitioning of the energy in the system is extremely rapid, of the time scale of 1 over QS. And if QS is of the order of 1 GeV, then the time scale of this equipartitioning is of the order of about a quarter of, or a fifth of a Fermi over C. It's very difficult to judge from these simulations whether you reach real thermalization because they're classical, and at the end the system is dilute and the classical approximation no longer applies. But the equipartitioning certainly works very well. The simulations at the moment are unrealistic in the sense that they only involve the transverse plane but not the longitudinal direction. And so one of the big challenges at this time is to do a 3+1 dimensional simulation of these classical dynamics without the boost invariance. And why this should be difficult and complicated will come back in a moment. But this has to do with the thermalization problem. That this should work, or at least work to a significant degree, is suggested by a very simple back of the envelope type models of this physics. For example, Kazeev and Levin have simply assumed that the nucleus at momenta up to this saturation scale is essentially black, which means that when two nuclei collide, then all the gluons with transverse momenta below QS get liberated. And then you can ask the question, how does this saturation scale change as a function of x or as a function of the rapidity? And for those of you who are not dealing with the experiments all the time, the rapidity is defined as this variable in terms of the energy of a particle and its longitudinal momentum, whereas the experiments often measure what's called the pseudo-rapidity, which I denote as eta, which is just minus the log of the tangent of this, the angle at which the particle is emitted. For massless particles, the two are the same. Otherwise, they slightly differ, and they have to be converted into each other. But they are approximately, they're very close in the case of these collisions at Rick. And you see that with such a model, you can very nicely describe the multiplicity distributions in rapidity that are observed by the data. However, there is a caveat. And the caveat is that in order to achieve that agreement, this scale was fitted to the data. We do not know from independent experiments what this scale is in the case of a gold nucleus, because nobody has measured the gluon structure of a gold nucleus at small values of Jurgen X. The scale chosen in these calculations is probably too large. That's too large from independent theoretical arguments, but also because some of the particles, some of the entropy that is observed in the final stage should be produced not in the initial collision, but during thermalization. And so trying to fit the particle number emitted at the end in terms of the initial gluon production is probably wrong. One should produce only about 50% or so of the final number. But in terms of the energy dependence and rapidity dependence, this seems to work, at least in such simple approximations. Now let me next say something about the thermalization and why it is a bit of a mystery. If you think about how, if you liberate gluons in the initial collision between two gold nuclei, you can ask the question, how does the system of gluons thermalize? Well, there is a perturbative approach to that. Namely, you look at the binary interactions among gluons and radiative processes following these interactions and see whether the system actually reaches equilibrium. This was done in detail by Biermüller, Schiff, and Son a number of years ago, and they call this the bottom-up scenario, where they begin with the hard gluons that are released from this initial saturated state, which then, as the system expands longitudinally, become dilute. So the classical system becomes a system of dilute interacting particles. They collide and radiate lower energy thermalized gluons. And in this, one can deduce a thermalization time which scales as alpha s to the 13/5 times the saturation scale to the minus 1. And if you put in the numbers, you find that this is of the order of 2 to 3 Fermi over C, whereas previously what I told you is that in order to understand the phenomenology of the collisions, we need a thermalization time that is less than 1 Fermi over C. And there's no way that this can yield such a short thermalization time. Other people have looked at this in different ways, writing Boltzmann equation algorithms and so forth. The general conclusion is that the perturbative dynamics among gluons does not seem to lead to thermalization. So why is matter thermalized? Why does it look thermalized? Well, you can ask Damson in detail, but it has to do with the fact that you have to estimate the parametric dependence on alpha s of the cross-sections among particles, which are screened by color screening. So there's the bi-length that contains alpha s. You have the cross-sections themselves, and you have the radiation probability. And when you add all this together, you find magically that it's 13/5. It could be some other number, but it is just a product of different factors of alpha s that comes from the various ingredients of the process. Is that correct? And of course, 13 and 5 are both prime numbers, so who knows what the magic is there. However, it doesn't work anyway. very recently, over the past year and a half, there has been a development that I think is very exciting and very interesting, which has to do with the fact that when you look at this diluted cloud of gluons, which are now the longitudinal momenta are separated by longitudinal free streaming, but the transverse momenta are still very large, you have a distribution in phase space, in momentum space, that is actually very anisotropic. The gluons at a given point in space have very large and certainly a transverse momentum, but are all ordered by longitudinal momentum. It turns out when you look at the dynamics of soft blue fields in the presence of such a cloud of gluons, there is a instability. There is a mode or a range of modes that can grow exponentially, which has been investigated by several people listed here. And this leads to the rapid growth of certain modes with momenta of the order of g times qs, where g is the coupling constant, which then act as background fields in which the hotter gluons can move, and since they are abelian fields, they basically lead to a bending of the trajectories of these hot particles with the possibility of randomization. This can be simulated, and again, this is where a lattice comes in and where there are studies being done right now in order to simulate that process, where you describe the soft fields in terms of classical variables on a three-dimensional lattice, the hard gluons in terms of color charges that generate these fields. And there are different ways of putting this into a numerical simulation where the soft fields are on a lattice. Either one treats these hard particles as point particles that move classically inside the fields, or one treats them, one takes multiple moments of them and couples them to the equation. There's a potential problem with such simulations, and that is because the particles effectively move at the speed of light, whereas the short distance modes on the lattice have a dispersion relation that makes them move slowly. But in any case, what this describes is that as you grow these abelian type strong soft fields, the hard gluons that move in the transverse direction can be deflected, and in this way their momenta can become isotropic in a very efficient way. Clearly, a theoretical challenge at this point is to do a full 3 plus 1 dimensional simulation of the hard-soft dynamics that begins with a very far-off equilibrium situation. And this also suggests why the conversion of the two-dimensional calculations that I talked about before, of the classical dynamics of how these initial glue fields equilibrate or equipartition, should be much more difficult if you include the third dimension, because then this physics has to be included as well. So now let's assume we have understood this, and we're talking about world after thermalization. In this case, of course, we can apply relativistic hydrodynamics. What this requires is that the mean free path for particles in the system is much shorter than the size of the system. But it also requires that the shear viscosity, and in principle also the bulk viscosity, of the system is relatively small. You can then write down the hydrodynamic equations with a viscosity term. And you can ask, how big is that viscosity term in QCD? Well, there are perturbative calculations of the shear viscosity, and they give you a result that goes like, well, t cubed over g to the 4 times a logarithm of the coupling constant and a very large number in front for three quark flavors. An interesting dimensionless quantity is the shear viscosity. So this is not the pseudo-rapidity here. It's the shear viscosity divided by the entropy density. This is a dimensionless quantity. Classical transport theory says that the shear viscosity is a number of about 1.5 times the density of particles times the temperature times the mean free path of the particles. The entropy is about 4 times the density for an ultra-relativistic gas, which says that eta over S should be of about 0.4 times the temperature times the mean free path. So if the mean free path is very, very small, then this could be a very small number. However, you would expect that the mean free path is somehow controlled by the temperature in such a system. So you would expect that this has to be something of the order of 1. However, when you do calculations solving the hydrodynamic equation for a nuclear collision with the initial conditions as you set them up in a gold-gold collision, and you ask, how do you produce in these the elliptic flow velocity, the parameter measured by the experiments here by these data points, then you find that you need a ratio that is of the order of about 0.1 or 0.2, maybe 0.3, but certainly nothing of the order of 1. In other words, the shear viscosity has to be extremely small. An extremely small shear viscosity means the mean free path is very short, which means that the system is very strongly interacting. So this has led to the conclusion that the medium that we observe at RIC, the quark gluon plasma observed at RIC, with a temperature that is above but not much above the critical temperature, is a very strongly coupled quark gluon plasma, not one that is described easily by perturbation theory. A lot of excitement, of course, was generated by work by Son and collaborators, which showed that in strongly coupled supersymmetric gangmills theory, this ratio is 1 over 4 pi, which is much smaller than 1. It's actually smaller than what you need in order to understand the RIC data. There's clearly an interesting question whether this is truly an absolute lower bound on eta of S, but it is, more importantly from the point of view of RIC, important to understand whether you are reasonably close to that bound in real QCD. Now, I mentioned that such a small ratio of the shear viscosity over the entropy density implies a pretty short mean free path. And if you convert it into normal variables, you find that the mean free path then is about 0.3 times the interparticle distance. In other words, it's a system in which typically one particle can move only about a third of the distance to the next particle before it collides and interacts strongly. So here we have another challenge. One is, these simulations are all done in a very simplified relativistic hydrodynamics, where you prescribe the longitudinal expansion and you just solve for the transverse dynamics. One clearly needs 3+1 dimensional relativistic viscous fluid dynamics calculations that confirm that you really need such a small viscosity. The other thing, of course, that you need is we need to understand what this ratio of the shear viscosity over the entropy density is for real QCD. And this is where, in principle, lattice calculations come in. The shear viscosity in terms of quantities that you can calculate on a lattice, namely components of the energy momentum tensor, is given by such a Cooper formula. And of course, the problem here is that it's something that has to be calculated in Minkowski space. But a few people have been very brave and gone on and tried to make such a calculation. Here, Nakamura and Sakai, not too long ago, used methods to parametrize the spectral function by comparison to the Euclidean Green's function, and then using this fit to determine the retarded Green's function and calculating the shear viscosity from it. And their numbers that they get have very large error bars. They're close, but not too close to this limit of 1 over 4 pi. But they clearly indicate that the shear viscosity could or should be small. and actually may become smaller as you go down to the critical temperature. But clearly, improved calculations of that type would be very interesting. If the shear viscosity is too hard, one might start up as a warm-up problem with the electromagnetic conductivity. This is related in classical transport theory to the average square charge of the particles times the density times the mean free path divided by 2t. And so for a three-flavor quark-gluon plasma, the ratio of the shear viscosity over the electromagnetic conductivity is 20t squared. So if you can do one calculation, you get a reasonable estimate of the shear viscosity as well, apart from maybe factors one or two. There is a calculation out there by Gupta which gives a value that certainly does not satisfy this, but it would be interesting and clearly a challenge to improve on this. Let me next come to the QCD equation of state. These are the latest calculations from the Bielefeld group for 2, 2 plus 1, and 3 flavors. If you convert the energy density divided by t to the 4, you get something that's related to the number of degrees of freedom of massless particles, which I call nu. Clearly, a challenge for lattice theory is to obtain these equations with light domain wall quarks, so that one has full control over current symmetry. But I guess this will be done in the next few years with the new machines. Another challenge for the RIC data is to devise a method for determining this value of nu, a measurement of nu from the data. And I'll say a few words about that. And finally, a challenge again for lattice theory, I believe, is to identify what the degrees of freedom are as a function of t. Obviously, we believe that as you take t to infinity, where the coupling becomes weak, the degrees of freedom are thermal quarks and gluons, which weakly interact. But does this remain true as one approaches Tc? What not? And in terms of the strongly interacting quark-gluon plasma, you could also phrase this somewhat differently. Is the system in the domain here, as it is explored by Rick, a gaseous, a liquid, or a solid plasma? I don't think anyone believes it could be solid, but the question whether it's gaseous or liquid is an interesting question. Even to think about how to determine that is clearly a challenge to theory. Well, this is exactly a challenge. I mean, I know exactly what the difference between a gas and a liquid is when I swim in water. Right. Yes, right. And so, and yes, you're right. And so it may not be well-defined in the sense of a yes or no answer. But if one has a scale on which one goes smoothly from gas to liquid, one would really like to know where on that scale you are. And this is clearly a challenge that we have. If it's a dilute gas, we could do Boltzmann-type transport. If it's a liquid, clearly we cannot do that. But where are we? That's a question that has really been thrown up by the experiments and their interpretation. Let me say a few words about how to determine from the data, possibly to determine from the data, what the value of nu is. Actually, in the range of Rick, if you take the lattice results that we have, the value of nu that you would determine is of the order of about 30. It's not 47 for three flavors because, first of all, the strange quarks are massive, and secondly, you have that reduction due to the interaction, but it's about 30. And we would like to know from the experiments whether nature tells us that it is 30. You could, of course, determine that if you have a measurement of the energy density and the temperature. Unfortunately, at the moment, we don't have a measurement of the temperature because the only way to determine that is by seeing thermal photons emitted from the system, and that hasn't been achieved. It may at some point in the future, but at this point, it's not clear that it is possible. Now, Krishna Rajagopal and I when we thought about this problem, we realized that you can actually take the two equations for the energy density and the entropy, which contain the number of degrees of freedom, and obtain a relationship that allows to obtain mu from a measurement of the entropy density and the energy density if they can be measured separately. And these are quantities that in principle can be deduced from experiments. What you need in order to obtain a lower limit on mu would be, for example, to take a lower limit on the entropy density and an upper limit on the energy density. What we have from the Birkin formula is interestingly a lower limit on the energy density, so we need a different observation to give us an upper limit. So how can one measure epsilon and s? The entropy, of course, is related to the particle number, and as we pointed out, the experiments indicate that the shear viscosity has to be very small, which means that there's very little entropy produced after the initial thermalization in the hydrodynamic expansion. And so we can deduce the entropy density from the final measured entropy, at least within certain error bars. For the energy density, it's more complicated. The reason, as I argued before, is that the energy contained in the transverse degrees of freedom is not conserved during the expansion. There's work done in the hydrodynamic expansion, and so hydrodynamics cannot be directly used for this purpose. However, there is a new measurement at RIC that is possible, namely the energy loss of partons. This is the jet quenching. And the energy loss is actually coupled to something that we believe is directly related to the energy density. And we'll say a few words about that in a moment. Let's first talk about the entropy. There are two approaches to determine the entropy from these collisions. One can, first of all, look at the particles that are being produced, make a chemical hadron model that fits the particle abundances, and then determine at the moment of hadron formation the composition of the system, and therefore also the entropy at the moment of hadronization. One can also look at the final particle yields that are emitted. In this case, one also has to include measurement of the size of the system at that moment. And both of these have been explored. The second method is clearly closer to the data. This requires some additional assumption. On the other hand, this does not require a measurement of the system size, because at the time of hadronic freeze-out, there's very little transverse expansion that has happened by that time. Fortunately, both of these results agree within the errors. And so we know now that the entropy per unit rapidity produced in a gold-gold collision, a central gold-gold collision RIC, is about 5,000. So that's a hard number with an error of less than 10% that we can deduce from the data. And I'm sure with improved studies, this can be reduced to maybe a 5% error. So let's say we have this. The lower limit on the energy density that is obtained from the measurements gives us a value of 4.2 GV per cubic Fermi. If we put this in our formula, we find that at 1 Fermi over C, we get a number of degrees of freedom of 71. Now, I remind you, this is a lower limit on the energy density, and the energy density appeared in the denominator of the equation. So, of course, this is an overestimate of the number of degrees of freedom, but we can say from the data that the number of degrees of freedom in the matter that is seen at RIC is less than about 30. It cannot be more. Now, of course, we believe it's 30. What would give us about 30? Well, if the energy density at 1 Fermi over C were 7 GV per cubic Fermi, that would be about 30. If the energy density were 9 GV per cubic Fermi at the time, the number of degrees of freedom would be 12. Incidentally, a hadron gas, a resonance gas, gives you 12. But the challenge experimentally will be to find observables that determine whether at the moment of 1 Fermi over C, the energy density of the system is 7 or 9 GV per cubic Fermi. We're not there, but certainly it's not something that's out of the range of the possible. What we think is the, maybe the best approach to this is to use the measurement of the energy loss. We talked about the suppression of the emission of high PT hadrons, and we understand this as being due to the fact that the parton that is originally scatters encounters energy loss and it goes through the medium and then fragments outside the system, but with less energy than it initially had, and so it's a suppression of high PT hadrons formed in that system. The process of energy loss in a dense system has been studied extensively in QCD, in perturbation theory, and there's a general agreement that the dominant mechanism is elastic scattering on color charges in the system followed by gluon radiation. And so if you look at the fragmentation of the original parton, it has given up some of the energy into a gluon, which means that it is has less energy. Of course, there's overall energy conservation, so really the energy in the jet overall is not suppressed. But if you look at the leading hadron, it has less energy than you would expect. The parameter that controls this process is called Q hat, and it is the averaged momentum transfer in an elastic collision in the medium. It turns out that this is proportional to the gluon density, which controls the density of scattering centers, and therefore to the gluonic energy tensor, energy momentum tensor in the system. So we'll come to that in a second, okay? How it is connected in this way. So here are some additional data about the energy loss at RIC and fits to those using this formalism by two different groups, which generally agree that when you obtain fits to what the data measure about the suppression of a factor of 5 and its dependence on the overlap of the nuclei in the collision, that is the number of participants or the centrality, that the data suggests that this energy loss parameter normalized to the time of one Fermi over C. Of course, it's density dependent. So as the matter expands, it changes, but you can normalize it back to the time of one Fermi over C is of this size, about 5 to 10 GeV squared per Fermi. It's very large. And so again, this suggests that the system that you produce is very strongly interacting. In fact, you can compare it what perturbation theory would give you. This is a famous plot that was produced by Rolf Beyer a number of years ago, which showed this calculated parameter as a function of the energy density for three different types of matter: a quark gluon plasma, a pion gas, and for cold nuclear. What do the data tell us? The data tells us that's the value you need. Significantly larger by about a factor of 5 than what perturbation theory, at least with the assumptions of alpha S and so forth going into the calculation, give you. So this is why we believe that this is actually indicating considerably stronger interactions than perturbation theory would suggest. Now, not everybody who does these calculations agree, because there's some people who produce a line that is not here, but that is shifted. So a big challenge, clearly, for phenomenology is to do a controlled, realistic calculation of gluon radiation in a thermal medium to tell us what perturbation theory really predicts for this line. Now, when this plot was first shown, people were disappointed because it said that when you measure Q hat as a function of energy density, you can distinguish between a quark gluon plasma and a pion gas. But of course, in the light of the previous discussion, where the number of degrees of freedom is related not only to the energy density, but also the entropy density, a pion gas and a quark gluon plasma at the same energy density have very different entropy, because a pion gas has 3 degrees of freedom and a quark gluon plasma 30. And so you can distinguish between these two scenarios if you also measure the entropy density, and we have the entropy experiment. So if we can actually determine the position of this line more precisely, from the data and from theory, and agree with all calculations, we can obtain a measurement of the energy density. Let me spend a few minutes. When did I start and when should I end? Okay. So let me say a few words about the question that Son asked. If you ask the question, how is it possible to even address that question on the lattice? You have to ask a formulation that is amenable to lattice calculations of the energy loss. And the way you go about this is the Eichonal formalism, where you start out with a quark, with a color alpha, propagating through the system, coming out with a different color beta. And of course, that conversion, that color rotation, is governed by a link variable of the lattice fields, the blue fields, along that line, which runs essentially along the light cone. Now, the gluon radiation then leads to the conversion of a quark, the configuration as a single quark, to a quark plus a gluon, but the gluon travels at a slightly different transverse position than the quark. And so, when you calculate the number of gluons in that formalism, you find that it is related to an integral over these transverse positions of the gluon of a correlation function that basically calculates along a light cone direction the line integral of this expression here and goes back along the same direction but at a transverse distance. So this is the quantity that plays the important role. Now, when the momentum of the gluon relative to the quark is sufficiently large, that, and it turns out when you think about this, that it actually has to be sufficiently large in order to be emitted within the short time that it goes through the system, then you can calculate this in terms of the power series expansion and focus on the small distance limit of the transverse direction. When this becomes expressed in terms of the square of that separation times the length times the correlator of the gluonic energy momentum tensor along the light cone direction in the plus I, where I is a transverse direction component, multiplied by a correlation length. And so this expression is what in the perturbative theory was denoted by Q hat. So the relationship is that Q hat is proportional to such a correlator multiplied by a correlation length. And so one of the challenges, I think, would be to try to calculate this correlator, F plus I, on the lattice, along a light cone direction. Again, this is something that is not obviously immediate in Euclidean lattice gauge theory, but it is not so unlike the calculation that's needed for the gluon structure function. And maybe moments are usable in order to do a calculation and at least obtain a normalization of perturbative calculations. Let me not say very much about heavy quarks here. That's been a domain of lattice gauge theory for quite a while. One of the ways to probe the system is to look for the color screening of the forces between two heavy quarks, a heavy quark-antiquark pair, and also now in the light of the energy, the hadron suppression energy loss measurements at RIC, to look at the energy loss of a heavy quark that goes through the system. And also, heavy mesons are very good probes of the collective flow. The RIC program will provide plenty of data on charm quarks and charmonium. The LHC program in a few years will do the same for B quarks and the epsilon states. The data at RIC charmonium are in hand. They've been measured in runs 4 and 5, 5, run 5 just completed, and we'll see them analyzed this summer and the results reported at Quark Matter. So this will be very interesting. Let me just briefly mention that attempts to deduce the spectral function in the charmonium channel from quenched lattice QCD calculations suggests that the charmonium resonance survives above the critical temperature. So that even up to about twice the critical temperature, charmonium may survive in a thermal medium in equilibrium. The big challenge here clearly would be to generalize that calculations to unquenched QCD. And the reason why that may be very different than quenched QCD is that when you think about the physics that goes on just below TC, the breakup of charmonium happens through the immersion of a light quark antiquark pair and the formation of two D mesons. So if there is a continuous transition in the mechanism, then light quarks may play an important role in the destruction of charmonium. Let me just jump over this. Briefly come back to the hadronization mechanism that I talked about it in the beginning. This puzzle why we see in intermediate momenta more variance than we think, but fewer mesons than we expect. We believe now that this has to do with the fact that when you have an isolated system like a proton-proton collision, then hadron formation, at least at larger transverse momenta, happens by fragmentation. You produce a high momentum quark, which pulls a quark-antiquark pair out of the vacuum, forms a meson, and so forth. It turns out that in this process, the ratio of baryons to mesons is almost always much smaller than one, because in order to make a baryon, you have to produce two quark-antiquark pairs, or a diquark pair, which is energetically suppressed. On the other hand, if you have a system that is dense, where you have lots of quarks and antiquarks, you can, of course, form a meson by recombination and a baryon by recombination. And the remarkable feature is that one can show that in a thermal system, the two processes are equally probable, and so the baryon to meson ratio becomes one. Now in the central region PP collision, it goes up to about, it depends on the momentum, but it goes up to about 0.4. Whereas in the case of Rick, the ratio is even above 1 are found. Which suggests that in PP, there's not just fragmentation, but there's something else that may go on. And of course, people have speculated about this in terms of recombination for 30 years. And the reason why recombination can win, and always wins in the thermal environment, is that in order to make a hadron of a given momentum, you have to find the quark-antiquark pair, each with lower momenta, which are, of course, much more abundant. Whereas in fragmentation, you have to take energy away from a hard proton, which has much higher momentum, and is much less abundant than the hadron you want to form. And so, by very simple probabilistics, you find that recombination is always dominant if you have a strictly thermal source. But of course, if you have a power tail, a power law distribution, as you have in QCD at very high momenta always, then it's fragmentation that dominates. Let me skip over this. One way of testing this is to go back to this elliptic flow relationship that I showed you. Because if you have recombination, and you expect that the elliptic flow of a meson is actually composed of the elliptic flow distributions, the anisotropies, from the original quark and antiquarks that recombine. And you find that in order to obtain the elliptic flow parameter for a meson, well, you get twice the elliptic flow of a quark, approximately, that is, at half the momentum. Now, if there's a wave that shares the momentum unequally, then you have to convolute this with the wave function, which you can do. But in a good approximation, this remains true. And for a baryon, you get the same relationship, except you have to take a third of the momentum, and you get three times the elliptic flow. We saw in the beginning this plot where I had the elliptic flow parameter measured as a function of PT. And I argued that for low momenta, we had a very nice agreement with hydrodynamics. It turns out that when you go to higher momenta, this is no longer true. Now, at some point, you would expect that hydrodynamics does not apply anymore because the mean free path of a particle with high momentum becomes long compared to the system. But what you find is that the elliptic flow for baryons is typically larger than that for mesons. So if you believe that recombination is important, you go back, you use these relationships, and you convert the measured elliptic flow parameters for mesons and baryons into those of the underlying quarks. They should give the same. And that's what happens. All the measured, and this does not show all the measured hadrons, but there are plots that I didn't have at the time where experimentalists have put in many other species of particles, converted into the underlying quark elliptic flow curve, you get a universal curve. This line is what you would get if you had pure hydrodynamic flow. For massless particles, then you get a straight line, it turns out. This line is what you would get if you had a saturation, which would be essentially, at high momenta, you can think of this elliptic flow parameter not as a flow, but you can think of it that if you have a system that is spatially anisotropic, then the path lengths of a particle to get out in one direction is shorter than in the other. And so it gives you an anisotropy that comes from the angle-dependent energy loss, which gives you this kind of curve. So this would basically say when, at which momentum, typically a quark in the system would go from being essentially following collective motion to one you have single particle motion but angle-dependent emission probabilities. Which makes a great deal of sense that this is about, let's say, 800 MeV, which is about three times the thermal energy. Okay. Let me jump over this here. And let me just at the end mention a number of challenges I've not talked about. As I mentioned in the beginning, a big question is where is the QCD critical point? It's not relevant probably for Rick, but it is a very interesting theoretical question and very important potentially for experiments at low energies. An interesting question that has been posed again and again by theorists is whether there is an order parameter that somehow remains not discontinuous, but certainly not smooth, so in a mathematical sense singular, at the critical temperature, even for mu goes to zero. As you know, on the lattice, all the measured susceptibilities show a very sharp peak at the same point. And one can phrase this also in the way where the QCD has a Curtis line that provides the location of such a singularity for chemical potentials below the critical point as an extension of the first order phase transition line. Another question is, how well is QCD below the critical temperature described by a weakly interacting resonance gas? That's important because much of the phenomenological models of the final state assume this. Is it true? To which degree is it true? There's been remarkable work by the Bielefeld group on this in the last year or so, on this, which suggests that actually this is a good description, but to which degree, I think, would be very important to know from a phenomenological point of view. In addition to the heavy quark spectral function, say for germanium, for the experiments, it would be very important to know what the thermal photon spectral function is as a function of invariant virtual photon mass and temperature. There's been a lot of work on this as well. Another question is whether strange quarks are a good probe of the chiral order parameter for up and down quarks as it goes to zero. In other words, can strange quarks and strange hadrons be used as a signal for chiral symmetry restoration? And finally, is there anything that lattice calculations can do to help us understand the dynamics of the hadronization? In other words, as you go through TC, how you convert the system from quarks and gluons into hadrons? I don't know how this could be approached, but if anyone has a good idea, that would certainly be very helpful for the phenomenology. And there are many, many more challenges about which I will not talk, and I apologize to anyone who has a favorite here that was not mentioned, but as they say, enough is enough. And so let me finish here.